Hi, and welcome back to another Quick Cup of Knowledge. Joining me today is Debbie Martin. She's a licensed veterinary technician and a VTS in behavior. She currently practices alongside her husband, who is also a boarded behaviorist in the Texas area. Thanks so much for joining us, Debbie.
Hi, Dr. Marks. Great to be here.
Oh, we're glad to have you. And I'm really excited to talk to you today. You're a leading expert in so many behavioral topics, both fear-free and also in other initiatives around the country. But we really want to focus today on our reactive patients. I think a lot of us in general practice have struggled for a long time, not only how do we handle these patients to do the best medicine, but also what's the correct communication we should be telling these clients and strategies to help those patients not only feel better in the hospital, but also at home. So I'd love some of your feedback. What is the biggest mistake we're making today with those reactive patients?
I think probably the tendency, just human nature in general, whether it be veterinary professionals or pet owners, is that we tend to do a kind of wait and see. Like, let's see if we can get away with doing X, Y, and Z, and hopefully he won't react. But if he does, then we'll do damage control. And I think that's probably the biggest mistake we can make. If we can be more proactive and really watch for subtle signs, make sure we're trying to keep them below their threshold of reactivity to start with, we're gonna have a much better experience, not only for the pet owner, but also the veterinary professionals that are working with these animals, right? Because once you've pushed them past their point of acceptance, getting them back down is quite challenging.
And so when you mention, you know, let's not wait and see, let's be proactive, how early is early, right? So a client might come in and say, my dog growled at me once. Do we go full throttle ahead and say, oh my gosh, we've got a potential reactive patient? Or I'm sure there's sort of a continuum there. What is your advice to practitioners?
Yeah, and it can be challenging. Sometimes we don't know, right? Sometimes those little indicators are there and we ignore them initially until it becomes a bigger problem. But growling aggression itself can be a normal communication tool, and we can all use it at times, right? Depending on our day and how it's going. Sometimes we'll resort to aggression a little faster than other times. Dogs and cats are no different. They certainly can reach a threshold of tolerance and communicate with us, but hopefully that level isn't such a low threat that they're actually really needing to escalate. So I think it really depends on the context that it's happening in. If it's something benign, such as, I walked past him while he was eating and he chased me across the room and growling at me, that's a more serious issue than I stepped on his foot and it hurt and he growled at me. I mean, that's kind of understandable, right? He's gonna be, that hurt. But it didn't escalate from there. Right. So it really kind of depends on the context, how often it's happening, the intensity of the aggression or the reactivity, and how often it's happening, and can we manage that situation? Is it something that has to happen routinely, like putting a leash on a dog to take him out to go potty? Maybe that's the trigger, and we can't avoid it. Then we definitely need to address it early.
Let's shift a little bit to those patients that we're actively working with. And we've got a compliant client who says, I don't like to see my dog fearful or anxious, and we want to change this reactive behavior trend that's going. Part of that is behavioral modification, but for a lot of those patients, it's pharmaceutical intervention. And I think it, you know, certainly we love that today's veterinary industry is changing and being much more accepting of utilizing those kind of strategies. But I know we can't delve into all of that in a few minutes here, but what is your advice to people who are getting started in using anti-anxiety medications or SSRIs or some of these other classes of drugs to really help make a full treatment plan for these patients?
Yeah, sure. So when using medication, it really does need to be combined with behavior modification and training. The medication can help the animal learn a new coping strategy. It won't teach the new coping strategy. So if we just put them on medication, sometimes we'll see some behavioral change, but if we haven't changed the environment, we haven't taught them new coping strategies for those situations, the medication tends to be less effective with time. So really important that you're teaming up with someone that knows the behavior mod, can do appropriate behavior modification using positive techniques, not aversives or punishment. But then the medication can help facilitate that learning process, especially if we can't avoid these triggers. We can't find what's called a non-stressful starting point for the behavior modification or training to occur. The animal's already past their level of tolerance. And I think one of the big take home should be is that getting them on what we call a mainstay medication, this is going to be a daily medication, mm-hmm. right? You have other medications that can be adjunct medications to a daily medication or an event medication, like if there's a specific trigger, like a thunderstorm or something like that. But a mainstay medication is usually going to be something like an SSRI, so a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, a TCA, tricyclic antidepressant, or MAOI. The most common ones that my husband uses in his practice are SSRIs because they tend to have a little bit less side effect profile. And there are a variety of ones out there. I think it's important for the veterinarian to become comfortable with one or two of those that they feel pretty comfortable with, know their side effect profiles, know how they're used maybe in human medicine and also in veterinary medicine. And go from there. But having them on an SSRI is pretty important. I see a lot of dogs coming to us. The vets are trying to give the animals some relief, and they're putting them on just routine trazodone, which has some SSRI effects to it, but it's not a great mainstay medication. It works better as an adjunct medication or event medication for most animals. So I'd like to see a little trend away from just putting them on trazodone and maybe looking at some of the SSRIs, like Reconcile obviously is approved for use in dogs for separation anxiety, so we have FDA labeling for it for a specific condition, and the generics like fluoxetine or my husband uses paroxetine or Paxil mm-hmm. fairly routinely for some panic type behaviors.
And how about cats?
SSRIs are pretty common, and what's nice about with them is that they tend to be once a day dosing. Sometimes they're twice a day, but usually once a day dosing, versus the TCAs often have to be a twice a day. And cats often don't like the taste of the TCAs, so a generic like fluoxetine, SSRI. We avoid paroxetine in male cats especially, or any animals that have had any difficulties with urination, because it can increase the sphincter tone a little bit and cause some issues.
That's very good to know.
Yes.
Very good to know. You've given us a lot of tips today for GPs that really want to elevate the way that they treat their reactive patients, but let's face it, we don't always have time or maybe the knowledge base or the desire to really delve into some of these very challenging cases, which is where you and your husband and other behaviorists shine. So for those patients, can you give us some resources of where to refer, where to direct people for clients for additional reading, or where we can send some of our patients to really do the best for them if we are not necessarily that point?
Sure, and we really do a disservice if we just try to address it very quickly in a routine visit that they've scheduled. Obviously, if we identify an issue, maybe having them come back, if it's something that you as a general practitioner are interested in addressing, make sure you have the time to discuss those things and have the right information in front of you and feel comfortable with it. But having a great referral source, whether it be, I think it needs to be a whole team approach, not just the veterinary behaviorist. Obviously, that's kind of your gold standard for when we really identify abnormal behavior or very troublesome behavior, but it's not available for everyone, although a lot of veterinary behaviorists will do remote consulting with a general practitioner to help them with the cases that they may have. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's important to have someone that you trust, like a positive reinforcement trainer that can help your clients teach some of these skills mm-hmm. to their pets. And they can kind of help also identify when it's abnormal behavior and say, hey, we need to find someone else to help with this. Like, this is outside of their scope of expertise. Mm-hmm. Really knowing kind of their role in that kind of team approach is going to be important. So another great resource would be Fear Free Happy Homes. FearFreeHappyHomes.com has some great video resources on there, and it educates pet owners on how to find an appropriate behavior professional for their animal. There are a lot of people out there that call themselves behaviorists without any education. Really important to look at credentials, but it's not just credentials. I think it's important to team up with someone with your practice that has very similar philosophy, works well with clients, and that you guys match. Just like you wouldn't just hire any veterinarian to come to your practice just because they have a degree, you want to make sure that it's a good fit, and when you are referring to another outside professional, you're basically saying that we agree with the things that they're doing. So make sure that they're using positive techniques, that they're not using aversives like choke chains, pinch collars, shock collars, or even corrections to address these underlying undesirable behaviors, because those actually may inhibit behavior, but actually make them worse in the long run.
Such good points today. Mm-hmm. Real quick, what's coming up for you at WVC this year?
I get to do a fear-free handling lab with a great friend of mine and colleague, Monique Fairchild. We're doing that at the Oquendo Center. Mm-hmm. Amazing facility. We're going to be playing with kittens.
Oh.
How fun, right?
Jealous.
I know. And also, I get to go back to the Oquendo Center for the Veterinary Technician Symposium in March and get to do a full day again with Monique, looking at fear-free and how to implement that into your practice.
Fantastic. Yeah. So great resources for all of our listeners and viewers today. Thank you so much for all you do for the profession and for joining us.
Thank you.